I didn't do anything. All right, it was 15 years ago today. Little Sergeant Pepper music, please, maestro. This is the first of two parts of what really is the final lecture, the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Let me begin by giving you a very quick overview and then go back and spell it out in some detail. Central meaning... The central meaning of the Vietnam War appears to be that it revolutionized the conduct of warfare in this last half of the 20th century. Warfare is and always has been essentially mass and movement. That is massive firepower and movement in terms of mobility, in the case of Vietnam, afforded by the helicopter. This kind of warfare was transformed day-to-day combat that made the Vietnam War as different as from, say, World War I as that war was from the Crusades. Not only technological change, but it broadened the scope of warfare, the definition of warfare. It was no longer simply the purview of the soldier. War in Vietnam was such, being fought on both sides, as armed struggle and political struggle, and it required defeating the enemy in both sectors on either side. Indeed, one of the paradoxical meanings of the war is that an army can win all of the battles and lose the war. Such was largely the case for the American forces, which won virtually every battle they fought and every major battle, which was a record unparalleled in the history of warfare. Yet winning those battles did not mean victory, only that an opportunity was created to succeed in the political struggle, the political Dao Chan arena, as the North Vietnamese would say. And victory could not be accomplished without success in this sector. The outcome of the war had enormous lingering social, political, psychological effects on the United States and on Vietnam itself, understandably. It shaped both foreign and domestic politics in both countries and in other attendant countries, I would add, in 100 direct and hidden ways. As a result of the war, a new balance of power was created in Asia, and a whole series of changes followed from this. China's hostility for Vietnam hardened, eventually into war. There began a steady increase in USSR presence in the region, one that may now be tapering off, but up until at least a year ago was continuing to intensify. There was a protracted war between Vietnam and Cambodia. There was a massive exodus of refugees from Indochina, and there began a marked growth of regionalism among Southeast Asian nations. All of these post-1975 events probably were inevitable, given the outcome of the Vietnam War. That's sort of a general overview of what post-war Vietnam and post-war Southeast Asia became. The death toll. It is estimated at about 2 million, but we will never know for sure. Because of the kind of war it was, the ratio of civilian to military deaths was probably the highest ever. Probably 1 to 3 ratio. 455,000 in the south, 50,000 in the north. That's the civilian casualty toll. The Pavan PLAF casualties are estimated at 1.1 million. Arvin deaths are estimated at about 241,000. U.S. battle deaths, the actual battle deaths, totaled 46,299, plus an additional 10,326 non-battle deaths. This was out of a total of 9.3 million Americans who served in the armed forces during the war. About a third of them, a little less, were in country, as they say. They were in Southeast Asia, either in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, or in Thailand working on the war, or in the Navy in ships off the coast. The Allied country casualties, that is the Australians, New Zealanders, Thais, Koreans, and Filipinos, was 11,300. Overwhelmingly, though, and this is the important point, the burden of the war fell on the Indochinese themselves, not on outsiders. Very telling statistic here. The number of Indochinese, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia casualties, 99.8%. Foreign casualties, 0.2%. During the Vietnam War, with its many and varied casualties, there was a general sense that the end of the war, whenever it came, whatever it was exactly, would bring a halt to the death, killing, and suffering. This was the theme of one of the war protest movement's most popular or famous song, "All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance." But even those who supported the war probably believed that whatever else, the end of the war would mean that the violent deaths and dying would stop. But the end of the Vietnam War did not mean that. Chiefly what it meant was that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, famine, pestilence, and death, rode on unchecked across the face of Indochina. And they left in their wake an enormous toll in human suffering. We gave peace a chance, and the result was, if anything, increased suffering and death, in which people died by the millions. Some died in the mountain passes leading from China, from the China border to the plains of Hanoi. Some died in the Cambodian jungles and mangrove swamps. Some were claimed by the sea or the shark or the Thai pirates as they attempted to flee from their homeland as boat people, or were expelled from it for being Chinese. Thousands died of starvation and the many diseases which stalked the malnourished and the debilitated. Cambodia, under Pol Pot, was the worst of the worst. On a per capita basis, probably worse even than the Jewish Holocaust. The mass exodus from Vietnam, the boat people phenomenon, was one of the great human migrations of the 20th century. There was a bloodbath by any definition in Vietnam, for which you can see the forthcoming book by Carl Jackson and Jackie Desborough, both of the University of California, who have done a study on the post-war killings, in deliberate killings in Vietnam. Others were executed deliberately or inadvertently in their gulag re-education camps or in the remote new economic zones. All in all, it was a ghastly period for the people of Indochina, one of almost unbelievable misery. We don't have any way of totaling the casualty list, but I think it is certain that more people have died violently in and around Indochina in the years since the end of the war than died as wartime casualties, probably by a factor of two. All right, that is sort of my general overview of the Vietnam War. Now and to a somewhat more specific examination of what happened. It has now been 15 years today, actually yesterday, when in Saigon on April 30th, 1975, at 11:30 in the morning, I believe, Captain Bui Quang Tan of the Pavan 203rd Regiment rammed his Soviet-built T-54 tank, number 843, through the wrought iron gate of Independence Palace and brought the Vietnam War symbolically to an end. There was great irony in that moment. When the palace gates went down, most of us thought that whatever else, peace had at last arrived. Yet it was a scant 4 years later that I think, as I noted earlier, that Tank 843, now with a new commander, spearheaded Hanoi's invasion of Cambodia. And as of late last year, at least, Tank 843 was still there fighting, as far as we know. So why did things go this way? In every country in Indochina, in the three that presumably had, quote, won the war, why is it that things went the way they did, particularly in the case of Vietnam, which was obviously Hanoi, that is, obviously a clear winner? Well, let me tell you a war story, I think, which really does encapsulate it. Once during the Vietnam War, I was sipping a bottle of Ba Mui Ba beer on the veranda of the Saigon Continental Hotel with a visiting psychiatrist friend from New York who was doing depth interviews of revolutionary personalities. Walter Sloat, his name was. He was interviewing Viet Cong, a Buddhist, Angkor Pagoda Buddhists, Dai Viet Vietnamese, trying to get some sort of a sense of the different personality, revolutionary personalities of the Vietnamese. Anyway, we were sitting there drinking beer, and he was telling me he practices psychiatry. He has a practice in New York on Fifth Avenue, a very upscale kind of psychiatric practice, and he was telling me about all of his friends, or all of his patients, you know, and who they were. And they were all rich, and they were all famous, and they were all worldly successful, and there they were laid out on his couch, undergoing psychiatric treatment. And I asked him, why is this? And he said, well, you know, being frustrated by denial of the things that you dearly wish for is unpleasant and hard to cope with. But the real difficulties in life come when you get everything that you want. And I think that observation could well be an epitaph for post-war Hanoi and for its Politburo. It's a diagnosis of why things, a central reason why things did go so badly with this leadership, the Politburo leadership, which had suddenly, and rather to their mind somewhat unexpectedly, surprisingly, had gotten everything they want. It was simply a case of not being able to handle it. Briefly, what happened was, throughout all of Indochina, there was a kind of shroud of failure that settled on survivors, both the winners and the losers, victors and the vanquished alike. This kind of shroud of failure settled on their existence. And this is measurable by any index you care to use, economic, diplomatic, social, political, military, above all psychologically, I would say. The clear responsibility, it seems to me, rests with the dozen men, and there are no women, who hold the unchallenged authority, monopoly of power in Hanoi. And they simply have proved themselves incapable of dealing with a post-war peacetime world. The Hanoi leadership was exactly the right kind of leadership to face the French and then the Americans in long, hard wars. It was exactly the wrong kind to bind up the wounds of war, to launch the nation on a massive, what it needed was a massive economic development program and the establishment of reasonably good relations with its neighbors and with the world. There was throughout Indochina a holocaust, a bloodbath, or psychological trauma, or social pathology, whatever kind of metaphor, clinical or pejorative terms you want to use. Cambodia descended into a kind of surrealistic nightmare of anarchy, starvation, disease, mass migration, and then war. It was savaged by an extraordinary death rate, far worse than in Vietnam. And Pol Pot's brutalization of Cambodia in the name of social perfection is so incomprehensible that it seems to belong in a black satire or science fiction. I'm still not too sure what Pol Pot had in mind. I think we made the initial mistake in 1975 when he emptied the cities, I mean literally emptied the cities, and instantaneously emptied the cities, and we had these absurd, surrealistic scenes of a hospital where a person is getting a blood transfusion and the soldier comes in and orders the doctor and the patient and the nurses out, and so they go out, you know, on camera, and here's CBS photographing carrying the bed down the stairs and the nurse with the blood transfusion and the doctor saying, can't you let me at least finish this, and the soldier is saying, out. That sort of scene just repeated again and again made no sense to the outside world. And so I think the early sort of political assessment of Pol Pot was that he was mad. And this is what everybody was writing. Yes.
From 70 to 75, where did Pol Pot get his aid from?
From the Vietnamese.
And after 75?
Then it stopped. Then he started getting it from the Chinese.
The Chinese.
Well, he also had gotten captured a lot from previous government. Maybe you can say that he was mad, but the problem is that that isn't much of an explanation. I mean, it's like saying that Hitler in 1932 was a fanatic. That could be true, but you don't really explain very much by saying that. And so we didn't really try to explain Pol Pot, we were just saying the guy is mad. And the reason there was a difficulty on this is that he did not, and the Khmer Rouge and the UNCA, the organizational structure, did not spend a lot of effort trying to explain to themselves and to the world and to their own people what it is they're going to do. Quite unlike the Vietnamese, for example, Hanoi, which had an elaborate mobilizational, motivational, agitprop, self-criticism, cadre structure, in which they would explain endlessly, publish endlessly, go to great lengths in this whole Dick Van Among the Enemy program to explain what they're doing. The Khmer Rouge did none of this. In the years about 75 to 78, I went to Thailand, to the border, a number of times to try to do some research on what was happening in the villages of Cambodia, talking to Khmer who had come out. And you would say to them, what happens when UNCA, that was the name of it, the organization, which it means, which again is sort of a faceless, formless kind of UNCA, would come to the village, and they'd say, what would they tell you to do? And they'd say, well, they'd tell us to plant bananas. And so what did you do? Well, we planted bananas. And did they explain to you why you should? No, they just said plant bananas. Now, the Vietnamese cadre would talk your leg off as to why the revolution needs the bananas and why Uncle Ho has preached plant bananas and so on. UNCA did nothing, just plant bananas. So on the basis of this, we simply assumed that there wasn't much of a vision, there wasn't much of a format, there wasn't much of a intellectual construct of what Pol Pot wanted to do. I think that is now, I think generally agreed that is not right. There has been some work on this, and it does appear that Pol Pot did have a game plan, if you will. He had an articulate, rational, certainly in the sense of it was logical, idea of what kind of a society he wanted to create. It was utopianism, sort of at its extreme. But what he was doing was he was dismembering the entire Khmer society. Every major institution of society he was abolishing. He abolished government, for one thing. There was no government at all. There was a small headquarters in Phnom Penh, and then there was local village, but nothing in between. He abolished the marketplace. He abolished money. He abolished newspapers and libraries and schools. And, every modern armed forces. He, surprisingly, perhaps, that was a strategic thinking, that we do not have an armed force like other countries have. What we do is take our forces and break them up and put them in the villages. And each village has its own defense unit, and it is self-contained. And there is no hierarchy and no high command in Phnom Penh, nothing, just the village level. Thinking there, I think, was that it would make it most difficult, he fully expected the Vietnamese to invade, I think, would make it most difficult because that would mean they would have to occupy all 2,000 villages in the country rather than just capture the center, capture the capital, which is the normal way in warfare. You capture the capital and you capture the country as a result. At any rate, this was the concept, I think, was simply to remove the apparat that existed before all the way down. And what he had in mind, I think, was sort of 13th century Cambodia, the days of Angkor Wat. This was a glorious period in Khmer history. The era of Angkor Wat, of great architectural and aesthetic creations, in which there was in the country only villages and the emperor in the center, but no lines of command, no bureaucracy or anything in between. I think that was what Pol Pot wanted to get back to. Now, in doing this, of course, you are also eliminating many of the admittedly positive benefits of civilization institutions, such as medicine. I mean, there was no medical care to amount to anything in Cambodia. All the doctors were executed if they knew they were doctors. Anybody who could read, anybody who wore glasses was in danger of being executed. And so the thinking is that he was trying to return the country to the 13th century. Now, yeah, that does sound a bit mad. I think I've told you on this. At one point, I remember driving through, I was in New York downtown, actually at the Times, had lunch with some people there. We were talking about events in Cambodia and how they're emptying the city. And Abe Brumberg, I think, said, you know, civilization exists only because of the city. You cannot have civilization without a city, without an urban center. And Pol Pot is eliminating the urban center, so he's eliminating civilization. And we all agreed with that. Then on the way out to the airport, I'm going through the South Bronx, and this mile after mile of this incredibly terrible, you know, destroyed city, and people running in and out of empty, ruined buildings, and you know, the momentary thought strikes you, well, maybe Pol Pot has got something. You know, you take all these people and move them to North Dakota. Couldn't be any worse off than this. I don't really mean that, but I think what happened, I mean, there's a phenomenon that occurs with revolutionaries in the years before they take over, I mean, successful revolutionaries. In the years that they're planning the revolution and thinking about what they're going to do once they are successful, they look over at the revolutionary scene. That is, they look at the incumbent government and they look at the things that exist there, the problems particularly, and they ask themselves, how can these problems be solved? And the tendency over the years is to come up with ideas that you think will work, but they're never tested, and nobody rather argues with you or much about them or not, and they sort of gradually become articles of faith. Lenin, for example, went through this. He believed, as he wrote in 1905, for example, any literate file clerk can run the Bank of Russia. Well, the fact is, any literate file clerk cannot run the Bank of Russia or any other bank. Savings and loan, maybe, but not a bank. He also believed that you did not need an elaborate mechanism for distribution of production goods, and that literally you would have this factory making tractors, we'll say, and every morning there would be no management running this. All the workers would get together in the yard, and they would decide who was going to do what to build the tractors that day, and then not only that, but where the tractors were going to go after they were manufactured. Well, you can imagine how you can't run a tractor factory that way. And so when Lenin got into power, he tried this for a few weeks. His cadres came to him and said, this isn't working, it's a mess. So he said, okay, change it. And they did. Now, other revolutionaries did the same thing, even the Americans. George Washington and particularly Thomas Jefferson had some odd ideas about government, which they had built up over the years, and which they tried in the early days, and they didn't work. So the normal pattern is you say, okay, it's not going to work, we'll try something else. What happened in Pol Pot's case is that he never got to that point. And the Vietnamese invaded in 1979, but he'd been in power about almost 4 years, and apparently that wasn't time enough for him either to come to the conclusion that this wasn't going to work, or that he still felt that it still had good possibilities and would have gone through with it. Anyway, we'll never know now. As an experiment in political science, I think it was one of the... If you could have wandered through Cambodia invisible in those years as a political scientist, you must have been an incredibly interesting, if somewhat bloody-handed, experiment in the whole concept of governance, the notion that you can eliminate all the institutions of society and out of it will come a better, or hopefully a perfectioned society. Now, where did Pol Pot get these ideas? Nobody knows for sure. One common thesis is that one of his key people, a man named Pieu Sampan, who had a PhD from the Sorbonne in economics, in his dissertation lays this out. That's commonly, you find it in citations. So I have read this thing about 3 times, and if that thesis can predict what happened in Cambodia, I'll eat it. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think this French school of liberal thought is to blame for this. People in Moscow, of course, take a very sharp exception to the notion that Pol Pot was Marxist-Leninist, ever was. Some political scientists have said that actually what he was doing was to take pure Marxism to its logical conclusion. Marx, as you recall, talked about the withering away of the state. And he talked in these, eventually, first comes socialism, then you advance to pure communism, at which point you no longer need coercive organs. You no longer need an army, you no longer need police, you no longer need prisons, because all of the causes of crime and social deviance and so on are gone. You've created this utopian society. So you can interpret, I guess, if you want to, what Pol Pot did as a kind of Marxism carried to its logical or illogical extreme. There's one other explanation which is called the Chinese Peasant General Movement. In China, the revolutionary stream in the 1920s was dominated by Mao Zedong and the Confucianists, that is, educated Chinese in the classic sense of the word. And the lines there between educated and uneducated were very sharp. Either you had a classic Confucian education or you didn't have anything at all. And that was the way. And so these peasant generals didn't have anything at all in that sense. They had no formal education. They could hardly read. But a group of them had worked out what they believed was the proper, they knew about Marxism, and they believed themselves to be Marxists, but they had worked out a kind of agrarian society concept that very much resembled what Pol Pot did eventually. I remember I was at a conference on these peasant generals in the University of Maryland about 1976, and these were China people who were writing papers on the peasant general movement. And I was really struck in, you know, having been coming in from Indochina, listening to these accounts of what these Chinese generals in the 1920s were saying ought to be the proper social order, and it sounded just like what was happening in Cambodia right then. Eliminating the modern institutions and returning to traditional values and so on. So there were people like that that were around Pol Pot, and it could be that that is where at least part of this concept came from. Yes?
What was the name of the man who...
K-H-I-U-S-A-M-P-H-A-M. Q Sampan. He's really the number two, or number one man now in the Khmer Rouge or the Democratic Kampuchea. Pol Pot is supposedly retired. I don't think anybody believes that. If you want to make a judgment on this, I think really what Cambodia really was is an example of what happens to people when they get caught up in a kind of ideological dream that sort of blinds them to the fact that human beings are the reason for all social change. And people then become, as Pol Pot was, the willing or even eager to sacrifice all humanity just for the sake of an abstraction, a political abstraction. Stalin did the same thing, so did Mao. I mean, it's not unknown, but the thought I want to leave you with in Cambodia is we still have more questions on this than we have answers. And the basic reason is we don't have the historical data to make judgments as we do have in the case of Vietnam or even in the case of Laos. There's no paper trail to speak of with Pol Pot. All right, now turning to Vietnam. I don't want to say a lot about this. I have this schematic, Breaking the Machine, was done in 1976. And this is just a rundown of the changes which the North Vietnamese said that they were going to do in South Vietnam. They did do some of these, they didn't do others. This all seems pretty ambitious now, looking in retrospect. The northern cadres descended on Saigon with a kind of, originally, I think, with a kind of looter's vengeance. Their instructions were to break the machine, that is, to reorganize southern society. They were to install new social and political institutions. They were to emasculate the existing social relations, some of which had, in the village level had been standing for 1,000 years. Middle-class Southerners, ethnic Chinese, even independent proletarian-minded individuals such as fishermen were driven out, often literally as boat people. Sometimes with malice, but mostly, I would say, because of the thinking that there was no place for them in the new order. Almost 1 million Vietnamese fled their homeland, and I don't We who are not Vietnamese really can't appreciate the profundity of that statistic. Just as we who are not Vietnamese can only dimly understand what it's like. It was one of the most famous Vietnamese said, no longer to have a city to build or a country to love. Thus, I think Vietnamese deserve our sympathy and our understanding, and when necessary, our tolerance and patience. Actually, by any objective measurement, and such things are really impossible to measure objectively, but the Vietnamese have been the most successful emigre group that this country has ever received, as they've gone further in less time than any of the previous waves of immigrants before them, the Germans, the Irish, the Jews, the Italians, even the other Asians. There's one exception to this, and I wonder if you know what it is. There's one ethnic group.
Asians?
No.
No.
This is, no.
No.
Well, on a statistical basis, there's one ethnic group in recent years that has done even better than anybody else. Not only that, they've done better than the Americans. That is, their rate of getting rich has gone up higher than the whole country. Cubans. They were all middle class. It was all Havana middle class. It was a very atypical group. I mean, they're all lawyers, doctors, businessmen, plus about 2,500 loonies and crooks that, you know, Castro turned out. He opened the jails as well as the asylums. But actually, many of the crooks have turned out very successful. I mean, honest people. I mean, they turned out to be successful businessmen. The loonies, I guess, are still loonies. They've got 2,300 of them locked up in some fort in Arkansas they don't know what to do with. They sent them to Georgia to live with Jimmy Carter. That was his idea. Okay. Now there are, let me see, where are we here? Let's stick to the program. Yes, we are now down to number three, the historical repercussions of the Vietnam War. We have gone through the social pathology that was more or less Indochina-wide. The things which the northern cadres did here, I could go through these, but I think they're fairly self-explanatory. And I think more importantly, they are now pretty much history. The North came south with the very ambitious plans to really change society enormously. And they made some changes, but I think the history of it is that they didn't change very much. And what they did change didn't stick very much. So so much of this is simply a kind of a paper program. They did establish new economic zones, which in themselves are not necessarily bad. I mean, lots of countries do this. The whole Western movement in the United States was, in effect, an economic expansion of the same nature. The problem with the new economic zones in Vietnam, some of them, is that the land was uninhabited before anybody came there, and the reason it was uninhabited was it was uninhabitable. You simply couldn't make a living farming there. Other zones, such as in the highlands, very good land, very good agricultural prospects and so on. Vietnamese don't particularly like to live in the highlands, lowlanders don't, but in terms of economics or agricultural production, these were quite viable economic But nevertheless, a lot of them were not, and a lot of them were very badly managed. That is, they would move people out and promising that there would be lumber and tin for to build a house, there would be tools and seed and the necessities to get into agricultural business. And when the people got out there, they found that they weren't there. There'd been a screw up or something had happened. At first, in the first few years, they tried very hard to hold these people out to the new economic zones through roadblocks and so on. Almost impossible to do, and most of the people were slipping back into the cities, particularly Saigon. And it soon reached a point where the police didn't bother trying to force this very much, or they did sort of help half-heartedly. Re-education camps were much more draconian, although again, not deliberately, although that probably doesn't make much difference if you were in one, that they were not prisons. They were, and they're not run by guards, and there was a prison system, separate prison system in Vietnam. These were genuinely thought of as being educational institutions. The Vietnamese communists, as we've seen, have great faith in setting people down and lecturing to them for a year and convincing them of something. And if it doesn't work, then the whole notion is you go through another year and so on. So there was altogether probably about 2 million that went through these re-education camps. They were at five levels, and the level one was really it was a re-education program, and probably 750 or 800,000 went through that, and that consisted largely of people in villages going to Saturday morning lectures in the village square or the village marketplace, or maybe two or three times a week, in which for several weeks, or maybe four times in a month, you would get a lecture on what the new order meant. That was a level one re-education effort. It wasn't really a camp at all, and it was temporary. The level two were similar to this, except you went to an actual camp, usually outside of a provincial town, and you were expected to feed yourself. So you brought your own food, but there were no gates or fences on these. You could leave anytime you wanted. You could get into trouble if you did, but they were not. But then the level three, four, and five were much more a form of incarceration, and particularly four and five were the distinction then between being in one of those and being in a prison. It was a difference without a distinction, because technically you weren't in a prison, but by any other measure you were. And what happened, I think, here was originally in the level three and the level four and five camps, you were told that, and the reason they called them this in part was because the number of years, four and five, was the number of years of re-education that it was determined in advance that you needed. And that if you were a hard case, then you were sentenced, if that's the word, to 5 years re-education. And what happened, and then in the level four, it was 4 years of re-education. But what happened at the end of the 4 years was, in most cases, it was simply that we'll now give you another 4 years, and then five, another 5 years. And it became obvious that this had shaken down to probably 10 or 15,000 people, and what the regime really was thinking is that they didn't want these people out and running around, and they didn't really care what it was that they thought. They could become born-again socialists as far as in actuality, and that didn't make any difference, because most of these people were what you call the natural leaders of a society. That is, they're teachers and national assemblymen and writers and poets and so on. And they're the people, particularly at the village level, to whom people turn when they want advice or information and so on. And they're very independent-minded, usually, and therefore the danger was that if they were out and around, they could very easily be criticizing the regime or influencing people in some negative way. And therefore, we can't afford to let them out and around right now, maybe next year or the year after. And that is, it's come down to the present time when the thinking, there's probably 10 to 15,000. Now the thinking is, we still can't let them out and around in Vietnam, but we can let them out of the country. And that is, in fact, what is happening. They're coming here in batches of about 2 to 3,000. Other regimes have done something the same thing. You have the problem of these educated people who aren't just going, simply aren't going to fit into the new order, no matter whether they really are sort of pro-socialist or actually communist. In Germany, East Germany, as you know, they were leaving by the hundreds before they built the wall. I mean, East Germany was on the road to losing every doctor they had. Same thing in Cuba. The whole middle class is practically moved to Havana. Now that's one way of getting of solving this problem. It's certainly a lot better than executing them, which is what pretty much, I'd say, happened after the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union. anyway, let's see what else. two things. There was a level of ambition in which the original plan for the South and also the North was to create giant agro farms and district-sized farms, and that the ultimate goal here is that you would abolish all of the villages of Vietnam and relocate people into